When you're asking a question, you're in the act of learning. And that's all we as human beings can really do, is to keep learning, not think that we've arrived, and find comfortable people in comfortable places to ask difficult questions.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Let's Be Real podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Yunus, and I believe we need all the help we can get when it comes to living a full and free life. Here you'll find honest truth, practical tips, and perspective changes that help you embrace the miracle that is your life. It's an in-process conversation that's going to be unfiltered, and it better be fun. Let's get real together. Hey, you guys, welcome back to Let's Be Real. I'm so excited for our conversation today. I have two very new friends with me, Reggie Dabbs and John Driver, who have written a book called Not So Black and White. And these guys are going to lead us through a conversation about their relationship and their friendship and what they've been learning through the process. Reggie is a public speaker. He just told me that he's been speaking for the past 36 years. So he has a thing or two to teach the rest of us, I'm sure. Reggie, Reggie, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's good to be with you.
I want to ask you a question, which I don't know if you've been asked this before, but can you tell us about one super highlight or super low light from your speaking career?
Oh, I guess the super highlight is every time I get to do an assembly program and they laugh at my first joke. I know it's going to be okay.
It. You're like, I've got him.
I have it. The super bad is when they turn off all the lights and put a spotlight on you and you don't know where the edge of the stage is. I'm going to leave that right there because I might have friends watching this later. So I'm just going to say that's a low point.
Reggie, I love that you said that highlight, because as you said that, I was like, oh yeah, that's it. Like, that's the moment in that first couple minutes where you're like, yes, this is going to be an awesome conversation. Very cool. And John's with us too. John Driver is a writer. He is a executive and teaching pastor. He's a former history teacher. John, you bring a lot to the table. Thank you. Welcome to the show. Super glad that you're here. John, what was your favorite thing to teach in history?
Well, I really enjoyed teaching. I was an eighth grade and junior history teacher. That's American history. So, I mean, I like all of it, but I always really enjoyed that part because kids seem to really just jump in on it. So just fun stuff that I don't get to do anymore, but really enjoy it.
Well, as a mom of three teenagers I have an eighth grader and high school, college, great teachers like change kids' lives. I mean, I knew that as a student, but I'm experiencing it. And especially the hard ones who call out a lot in students seem to be awesome. So thank you for that. I'm excited to talk about y'all's book and the story behind it and get into a little bit of a few of the topics. Obviously, the book's amazing. I love it. And it's one that I really want to highly recommend to everyone. But we're going to at least gloss over like a few of the topics that you guys cover in there. But before we do, I just would love to hear the story behind the book. You guys tell a little story about an awakening that you had about your own relationship that kind of led to the book. So, John, I just love to hear maybe from your perspective on that. And then, Reggie, you guys jump in and let me know how that all has kind of played out.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I watched the video of George Floyd being murdered, there had been a lot of things swirling in me already up to that point. And as a white Christian, you know, my wife and I have been having a lot of conversations really for about 5 years, just about what our role should be in this conversation. And I was in tears. And, you know, one of the first things I did was order a bunch of books off Amazon to begin reading black authors and black theologians and others that I should have been reading the whole time. And then the next thing I did the next day was call my good friend Reggie, who after, you know, 20 years of friendship and two books we've written together, we'd really never broached a serious conversation about race. And so I, you know, tried to set up some respectful disclaimers of, hey man, you know, you don't owe me any explanation here. And I know that there's a lot of mourning happening here. And man, I've been sitting on the sidelines watching this from the outside and not inside this with you. So if you'd like to share some of your experiences, I'm here. You don't have to, but man, I've not been a very good friend to you, and I need to engage more. And so, how can I help? What can I learn? It wasn't a feeling that I needed to come save things. It was a feeling that I needed to be involved with my friend. And that led then obviously to so much of the discussion about the systemic issues and all those things. And so, you know, having a balance of understanding the relationship side of it and how that leads into an understanding of a lot of the hot button topics that people are losing their mind over. My journey began with a friend, and I think that that's the best place to begin this journey.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How about you, Reggie? Obviously, that was a marker moment for a lot of people. I mean, the whole nation. But I'd love to hear from your perspective.
Yeah, my whole thing is, and it's true what John just said. It's almost like we were able to build a bridge so that we can have the conversation that we had. We had a relationship where I know his wife, his daughter, he knows my family, my son, and I've been to volleyball games, you know, and just hung out. We've gone to dinner and just chilling. And that helped, you know, him want to call me, which spoke to our friendship. Even my wife says, "Isn't it cool that John thought of you?" Mm-hmm. And I went, "Yeah, it is. It is." And when he called me, he asked me, you know, "What's it like being Black in America?" And I've never in my life had anybody ask me that question. And for some reason, I put his daughter in a scenario. She's like ninth grade. She's about to start driving. Mm-hmm. And I put my son in and I said, "John, the best way for me to do this is when I put my son in the car to teach him how to drive, what's the first thing he did?" And I asked people this and they like, "Fasten your seatbelt." I go, "No, adjust the mirrors, the seat so you can close." "No, no." He goes, "What's the first thing?" I said, "Well, the first thing I tell my son is take your wallet out of your back pocket and put it on the seat beside you or in the cup holder so that when you get pulled over, you're not reaching in your back pocket and your life is over. That's the first thing." And John was like, "I would never have to say that to my daughter." And that's just a glimpse. And it's a glimpse that a lot of people have read, even in the book, that has opened them to, wait a minute, maybe there is something a little bit different. And it is. But having that conversation and John being willing to do it, I get emails almost every day or a text from somebody who's just finished the book. And they're just like, "Thank you so much. What a jewel." And be honest with you, me and John, I was worried for John. I mean, people expect the Black guy to talk about racism, but they don't expect his white friend to step out like that. And people have embraced it. But I was a little bit concerned about how John would be treated because he is my friend. Mm.
John, you mentioned, and by the way, it just makes me, it's so emotional, just that whole, especially at the Ahmaud Arbery murder. That was really a time of awakening in our family. Sort of like John, there had been some friendships and things, but I know for me, really trying to step into that space, it there was like an uncomfortableness to it. And John, you seemed to indicate some of that. You were like, "I feel like I want to call my friend Reggie. Is this going to be, you know," tell me a little bit more about kind of the feelings behind that and what you worked through to say, "I need to push into what kind of does feel uncomfortable."
Well, it's a minefield. It's a minefield when you've not been in the battle, especially. So you don't know where the mines are. Mm-hmm. I have a good friend as an author and, you know, we were talking one day and I told him, I was like, "Man, I'm sorry that I'm late to the game here." And he said, "You know," he said, "I tell my white friends who feel late to the game that that would really only matter if this game was almost over." He said, "But there's unfortunately a long way to go. And so, hey, you still got plenty of time to get involved." So I think there was a feeling of, if you're, and we discussed this a lot in the book, sort of the even white Christian evangelical sort of feeling that, hey, because laws have changed, you know, because there's obviously improvements, racism as certainly on a systemic level feels like a part of our like distant history. And there's not really an understanding. That was where it began for me. As a history guy, it was like number one, the 60s is not that far away in the grand scheme. And then you begin to really look at what's still happening today, or you watch through, you know, the sort of movements that we called law and order and the mass incarceration and all these things that have nuance and complexity and lots of different elements. We can't just sum them up so simply. But I was very dismissive of those issues. So when I began to realize, wow, there's a lot more going on in the nuanced layers of this, I knew I had to get in somewhere. Like, it's time. Mm-hmm. And it, for me, it was a righteousness thing. It was a, man, I, you know, the gospel calls me to a place of justice for the oppressed. And I know that those are strong words that are being weaponized by a lot of people. I think the relational kind of getting into that water was a place that I could, you know, and I don't want to think that this book is just about, hey, two guys are friends and that's going to fix all of this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there has to be an element, especially if we're believers, there's an element of saying, hey, but I can't walk this out in real life and learn these things without friends. And I don't want to just be a theorist. I don't want to just sit around having theories about racism and just speaking and shouting into the online ether about it all. I want to actually also be with people. And so how can I do both? I think both are important. That's why we talk about changing your heart and having your heart change. When we say the nation needs heart change, we rarely ever mean our own. Mm-hmm. We always mean somebody else. And so the gospel always says, no, we're going to start with yours. Mm-hmm. And so we began there, but we also know that systems don't have a heart and they also need to be changed and adjusted. Yeah. That's actually the vision of the founders. And so when we begin to understand that, we say, hey man, through these relationships and through what God brings for us, we can be a part of the change of hearts being with us and with others and also of the systems because both need to be changed just by different means.
Mm, yeah. Thank you, John. Reggie, why do you, in your experience with folks, you're prolific around the country. You've spoken with young people your whole career. You speak not on racism at first, correct? You've really spoken about your triumph through a very difficult upbringing. And why do you think that this topic is so uncomfortable and so riddled with, like John said, such a minefield? What has been your experience in that?
The very first thing that we do in the book is try to get people to set aside the stuff that separates us when we say the word racism, to set aside the insult so that we can get to the problem and so we can find a solution. Mm-hmm. So everybody wants to say, well, not my family. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wants to say, you know, I wanted to name the book My One Black Friend, but they didn't go with that one for me. I mean, I don't know why. I thought it would have been good.
We'll call it that on the show. That's what it is.
You know, I'm going to tell you, because everybody goes, you know, I have a black friend, or, you know, my brother-in-law is black, you know, and what it is, it's like almost a defense system where, you know, you got to, hey, I'm on your side, bro. I got your back. What we have to do is get past that. And that's why I love that John put in a little underneath it, you know, a discussion about racism and faith. Mm-hmm. Because without that faith aspect, how could we tackle something as massive as racism? Like you said, I grew up in the foster care system. I grew up, but my foster care parents, they knew that if they gave me faith, that it would get me through how I was born, that my mom gave me away, that I wanted to give up. But all that stuff all happened. And it all, that underlining, or I like to call it that crimson cord that connected it all, was that faith that I had to believe that what I'm going through now, there's something bigger, stronger, and faster than that. When we talk about racism, there's something bigger, stronger, and faster than that. And that's our faith.
Mm-hmm. I love that. You guys talk about, I just want to read a particular quote that I was like, I'm going to have to write that one down and underline it. So I did both. And it says, we don't want anyone to stop loving this nation, which obviously there's been some content leading up to that point. But just the fact that we have to say that somehow critiquing or desiring something different for our nation feels like you're not loving the nation. I do want to talk about that part. We don't want anyone to stop loving this nation, but we do want to cast a clear vision for what loving this nation well, according to the gospel, really entails. And I'd love to just ask either one of you to kind of walk us through what is going on, do you think, in our culture that's making this connection between somehow if we bring up mass incarceration, redlining, systems, we're not patriotic or we don't care about our nation? And how do we move past that as Christians?
Yeah, I mean, man, it's a big question. Obviously, it's what's blowing up everything around us politically. Somewhere along the line, I think that, and we have a whole chapter, you know, called When God and Country Don't Go Together. We're not against the ideas of being grateful for a nation and understanding that all blessings come from God. But a lot of the sort of core, I think, of where racism can be overlooked, so if it exists where it's easy for us to overlook it, comes out of this exceptionalism of that, hey, we kind of replace Israel even in the Bible with the United States. We sort of throw away historical context, biblical context, and take on a place, instead of going, hey, you know, God wants to bless all the nations. That's the central premise of the entire Bible. This idea that, yeah, but ours is a little bit better. And when you begin to believe you are a little bit better, you stop the things that could make you better, because there's a humility as at the central core. And if you really, again, as a history guy, and there's so much history in this book, there was a humility in the founders who made a lot of mistakes, but that they never like claimed to not make mistakes. There's a reason George Washington didn't want to do a third term. There's a reason that he talked about that we have the right to establish and to alter our states of government. The reason was he knew alteration would need to continue, and I'm not going to make a good king, everybody. We've had that before. So, you know, that monarchy was an exceptionalism. Hey, this king is above the rest of us. And somehow I think we've elevated this sort of idea of America sometimes above the real America. And so loving our country means, yes, let's defend our country. Loving our country means, yes, we're not out to tear it down. But the best way, and this is as a pastor in my life, like the best way to love people is not to convince them that they don't need to keep changing. Like actually to love them really well is to say, hey, how can you be honest about other places in your life where God is still working in you? He is still working. Now, how can you invite him into those broken spaces? And so there's broken spaces in America that I think a lot of the church is just going, you know, la, 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 la. No, this is God's place. Mm. It's like, if this is God's place, then God's ways should reign here. And God's ways begin with humility, being open to reason, being impartial. I mean, I'm quoting James right now. We should be, you know, slow to speak and quick to listen, and so slow to anger. And if our reactions are angry and they're not slow, they're quick to respond and quick to just throw out the especially perspectives of people of color who are believers around us. Excuse me. Then we should not call those things gospel-based. We should not call them Christian. So they may be political, and I'm not calling them invalid. Just don't call them Christian, because to begin with Christian begins with a place of, how does God change me? How does God change me? And how do I open my mind to be willing to listen? That's why a question we ask a lot in the book is when was the last time you changed your mind about anything? I mean, so when you said earlier, you know, you're establishing, you read that quote, what do these things mean according to the gospel to love our nation well? What we're really doing in the book is we're helping us, even though it's a book on racism, we're really deciding, what does the gospel mean? Mm-hmm. Like, what does it really mean to you as a believer? And so we're not calling you unsaved, and we're not throwing out all the past. We're not calling it all bad. That's that binary extremism that we all have. It has to be either good, all good, or all bad. And we're saying, hey, the real gospel is a safe place where you get to be broken yet redeemed. You get to be broken and being healed by Christ. You get to be broken yet continually being transformed into a different person. That's the real message that brings hope to the world.
Thank you, John. Reggie, you know, I've heard it said, and you mentioned, like, your one black friend. I got one black friend, you know. Yeah. So, yeah. And I think what that's really, thank you for laughing. I think what that's really like pointing to is this whole idea of like, I'm not a racist, right? You know, that idea of like, I'm not a racist. I have a black friend. And you guys talk about in the book, this idea of a heart issue and a systems issue. And you mentioned the story about the way that you told your son, you know, as he began to drive, this is the first thing that you need to know. Can you talk to us a little bit about, or just articulate for someone who's right there? They're like, well, my heart is, yes, my heart wants these things, but I don't understand how racism is a part of my community. Can you give us an example of what that looks like in today's world?
In today's world, it's very subtle. And it's even easier now to get away with certain things than it used to, because instead of a person of color going, you know, that's kind of might be racial, it's the other side. And people are like, oh, you think I'm racist? No, and they'll jump to that. So somebody has to back down. The way I look at it is this: when Jesus walked into a room and he sat at a table and he started to eat, there were people in the room going, why is he sitting there? Why is he sitting with them? And my first thought was, poor Jesus, that brother can't even get a fish dinner without people making fun of him, man. Can't let the brother eat, you know what I mean? Let him eat. And that is a small picture of, even then, there are people who wanted to be better, wanted to look better, mm-hmm. wanted to put themselves above others, where Jesus walked in the room and I know he was like, okay, let's take care of this because we're going to sit at a table where they never dreamed I would sit mm-hmm. at, because the Pharisees were there, everybody was there. But I love that about Jesus, because when he picked his disciples, he had gone to all the rabbi schools and everything. And then he was baptized by John the Baptist and the sky opened and even God said, this is my son. Then he went out and looked at fishermen and said, come follow me. He did something that he was supposed to pick other scholars, other rabbi. He's supposed to pick them, not a fisherman, but he changed the game because back then they didn't have the internet or Instagram. It wasn't on a news feed that Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist and God said he was his son. People heard by word of mouth. Mm. So when Jesus walked up to those fishermen and he said, follow me and I'll make you fishers of men. They dropped their nets, not because Jesus can make a blind man see, because he ain't done none of that yet. They did it because that's the rabbi that we can follow. Mm. Now, you're like, what's the correlation between that? Here's what it is. It's real simply this. We have to be like the fisherman. We have to be like, you know what? Whatever Jesus wants, we got to do. Mm. What if we, the church, could be a picture of what race should be like, mm-hmm. of what equality should be like. And we have an opportunity to do that now, but we have to just get, and I love it because we can look through Mike's lenses or we can look through Jesus' lenses mm-hmm. and we put it in the book to change the way your vision is, change mm-hmm. the way you see things and try your best to see it through God's eyes and you'll see where we should
be. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think you're continuing to point us back, which I appreciate so much, to the fact that at the core, like it is a heart issue of, am I willing to have my mind changed about something? Because if you've been, as I have and my family has been, if you've been in relative comfort, security, and things that have impacted other people have not impacted you, and you may not be aware of why those things have not impacted you, be it race, be it class, privilege, security, whatever. But this conversation is really about, well, what about opening your eyes to what does the world look like through, what does America look like? You know, like you said, what does it mean to be a Black man in America? Never having anyone ask you that means no one thought there was any difference between being a Black man in America and being a white man in America, apparently. I mean, so John, I'm curious, you talked earlier about this awakening, like feeling like you relate to the game, but it's actually a long game. And even as a history guy, I'm curious what you discovered about our modern systems that was shocking even to you. Like, obviously, if you had known before, you probably would have been more engaged. So you mentioned several systems, modern day injustices that are in our society right now. I'm wondering which of those kind of stood out for you.
Well, you know, I think probably instead of pointing out one, you know, there's a chapter towards the end of the book that it's a lot of citation of different studies. And for me, one of the big ones was the traffic stop statistics, and that are still very current. And this is over 100 independent studies, some by the Justice Department, some by the Justice Department in Republican administrations, some by independent or police departments across the nation who are doing their own sort of internal audits of this, that the number of Black men who get pulled over is like, you know, exponentially greater than others or Black people. And then the part that really shocked me was how those numbers go down at night. They go down at night because they can't see what color the driver is they're pulling over. Mm. And so, you know, and I had this conversation. I have a lot of, you know, again, we talk about your one Black friend. I have plenty of police officers and soldiers and others who are friends. I mean, this is not like an indictment against police officers. And I think that's where, like you said, that insult lies is, well, you're saying that police officers are racist. Okay, no. If we don't believe in systemic issues, then the alternate conclusion is very alarming, because if these statistics and they're validated often by the police departments themselves, so we're not talking about someone just throwing rocks on the outside, we're talking about they conducted their own investigations. I mean, in Baltimore and Ferguson and plenty of places, they've conducted their own investigations and have come to these conclusions. And so if you have sort of when that happens, what happened to George Floyd, that's just one bad apple. If you had sort of a bad apple viewpoint of racism and not a systemic viewpoint, then the conclusions are very alarming. It means that the entire system, that we have now is just riddled with bad apples. Mm. It means we just have racists all around us and all of our policing systems. And I really don't believe that to be, I believe there are bad apples, if you want to use that term, but a systemic understanding actually brings a more palatable conclusion and also a better path forward. Because instead of indicting all the individuals, and if someone goes down that individual path, that's on them, perhaps there is something in the systems. And of course, the history of policing, understanding where many of the police systems in America began as enforcement for the Black codes post-Civil War during, you know, early Reconstruction, then to enforce Jim Crow laws once we were, you know, past Reconstruction, you know, understanding that while we were mass incarcerating post-slavery as a way to take former slaves during Black codes and put them under vagrant laws where if they didn't own property and they stood on property, they were in violation of the law where they weren't allowed to own property. They didn't have any resources to own property. And so just standing, just being Black in America during that time was illegal in the South, especially. Mm-hmm. And they would take them back into custody and they would begin working the fields now for the government to pay the kickbacks to the landowners and vice versa, the same fields they were when they were slaves. Mm-hmm. And understanding that that history may seem like that's not ancient history. I mean, that's just, you know, a little over a century ago. And understanding like that's a valid beginning. And so there, and this is the term we use a lot, history leaves for us a legacy. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't mean that it's exactly like that today. It doesn't mean that the Civil Rights Acts haven't, you know, helped along the way. But we can't ignore that, hey, that beginning may have other tributaries throughout it systemically that are still affecting the current system today in some way that needs to be evaluated. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, how you start really, really matters. And it's really more difficult to unlearn than it is to learn. And so for me seeing, okay, well, the traffic stop thing, I could just go, a bunch of racists are out there pulling over Black guys. Or I could say, what is going on a deeper level here in the training, in the understanding of how those things go? And I mean, you know, again, no knock warrants, another great thing in the modern age. Yeah. I mean, the Breonna Taylor story, the idea that someone could be in their own home having not been convicted of any crime and someone could just break down their door and because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, they get shot, and the only person that had any law that was broken was one of the officers that shot into another apartment, into a wall, because that put someone else's life in danger. But technically, no one had broken any law who actually shot at another person that day. And that means, hey, guys, our law needs to be adjusted. And it was. The city of Louisville made some adjustments to that. That is systemic change by seeing the problem as it is and not just boiling it down to, well, this is a bad person because of you know, well, they're into drugs or into this and that. Hey, you know, we have to separate from the humanity of people just the behavior they have. And like Reggie was saying, Jesus separated humanity from behavior and loved people where they were. It doesn't dismiss the behavior. Jesus paid for the behavior. And so he cared about it so much he laid his life down, but he cared about the person even more to reach them where they were.
So good, you guys. You know, I remember particularly in during the summer of 2020, I had a few people who would reach out to me who felt that sense of overwhelm. I believe this. I don't have any Black friends. I don't know what to do. Like, what do you do about the traffic stop problem? Like, you know, just so, and I know you guys, you know, obviously the book is an incredible start, I think. And also the fact that you give so many further research kind of content, but what's your engagement? What is y'all's, how do you personally say, okay, this is what God's calling me to in this season. This is what, helping others kind of awaken to this and be involved in it looks like for each of you personally in this season. And maybe what would you say to others who don't have your platform, you know, like, and what would you say to that girl in Washington State who reaches out to me and is like, I'm a mom in Washington State. What do I do? So.
Yeah, to answer your question for her is you already did something because you reached out and you're asking questions. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think you have to have an action behind anything. No, when you're asking a question, you're in the act of learning. Mm-hmm. And that's all we as human beings can really do is to keep learning, not think that we've arrived, and find comfortable people in comfortable places to ask difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And so to her, I would say, you're doing it right now. You're asking questions. And that's important. I never dreamed that I would be in a book like this. Mm-hmm. I never dreamed I would share the stories that I went through growing up. Those were things, those stories molded who Reggie is. Mm-hmm. And I would never even had, you know, my son, when he got older, I shared some of those mm-hmm. with him. But you know, being African-American in a predominantly white denomination, and then becoming that speaker that they want to have in their church, you get up close and personal with some pretty difficult situations. Mm-hmm. So for me to do that, and some of my really good friends, they're like, you really did put it on the line in this book. And I said, I'm glad you realized that, but you got to do something, you know. And I kind of wish it wasn't on the scale that it is, because I mean, we ended up on national talk shows already and everything like that. But on the backside of it, I'm getting people who are like, hey, I'm a dad. My kids heard you speak and he made me read this book. And thank you. Mm. You know, I mean, I'm like getting stuff from kids, fathers and mothers. Mm. And I'm like, well, I'm old, but I'm like Uncle Reggie to every teenager. So I'm like, I'm just going to reach the kids. Every now and then I get to do stuff like the old school Promise Keeper events. Yeah. They would have me see. So that's about as adult as I get in my ministry world. But now with this, it's almost as if God set me up in my past so I can do this now to have a platform. Cause healing to go around. So I, that's just what's a little different and that I'm having to doing now is almost people are kind of comfortable asking me those difficult questions. Mm. And that's cool with me.
Yeah. You get to be a lot of people's friend that maybe don't have access to someone else.
I might be the world's Uncle Red.
You might be the, come on. You might be the world's one black friend. hopefully we can change that. But
can we name this to a whole session, my one black friend?
That's the title.
That would be
100%.
Come on, Joe.
Done for you.
I'm talking to Joe. He the boss. Come on, Joe. Let's do this.
Joe's our done. Producer. Yes. Reggie, you mentioned like telling some of those uncomfortable and really painful and also just unjust stories in the book. Have you had flack? Have you gotten?
No.
Okay. Well,
no.
Maybe.
And I really believe that it's that platform of 36 years, mm-hmm. you know, the people who are like, you know, I've heard him speak a couple of times. Okay, wait a minute. Wow. I've had guys come up and say, thank you. Mm. Just thank you for not giving up.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And that's pretty good.
So good.
You know, we had a little flack after Good Morning America, Reg. You know, we had a couple emails. And in those cases, of course, an 8-minute interview can't encapsulate mm-hmm. an entire 200-page book. And we weren't able to go on all the systemic issues and those things. But, you know, we've been trying, like a retired police officer reached out, you know, the day of and was just offended that we would, you know, insinuate these, you know, that there's a problem. And
yeah.
And we were able to say, hey, thank you so much for your service. And we're not insinuating that, you know, that you have a problem here, that there's a big thing going on. And how could we bless you as someone we honor with a free copy of the book? And just trying to respond. I mean, we're not always gracious. Reggie's always gracious.
So, I was thinking that.
Yeah. So John's not always gracious, but, you know, it's good to have a gracious friend. And I'd say too, you know, and you were talking about just to kind of tack on to what Reggie said. You know, one of the things in all of our interviews and talks, and as a white pastor, I get a lot of these, you know, conversations. And when some people have laughed when I've said, you know, probably this begins with being willing to change the way you think. Mm. Like, if you want to know how to affect this, be willing to change the way you think. And that's why, again, there's a reverse engineering into what you actually believe about the gospel mm-hmm. from there. That's why it's a bigger question than we think. And sometimes the initial reaction, not disrespectfully, it's just like, yeah, like, what will that do? And it's like, okay, guys, when we're at a place as believers, when being willing to change the way we think with a humble approach to how we view the gospel and God's viewpoint, as Reggie would say, God's lenses of not just this problem, but the people in this problem, then that's when we can say, maybe my viewpoint of the gospel, if anything, has become so familiar that I'm not allowing the real radical parts of what it calls me to inform how I look at everything. Whether it's political, whether it's social, like this needs to inform how I look at everything. And so, and it's not just about the book, but we really did write this book as an entry point for those who don't know what to do mm-hmm. and who just sit around going, man, I'm just so sick and tired of being called a racist. Like that's a big sentiment we hear from people. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll ask them, who called you a racist? and they can't name anybody. It's a general feeling, or they're being told maybe by their media outlet that, hey, everyone's calling you a racist, and like, but they haven't actually encountered that in an actual human. But the belief and the impression is everyone thinks I'm a racist, and they're on the defensive and they feel indicted. And this book is for them. Like, hey, I've been there, and you don't have to be there. There's a better way, and you don't have to be controlled by the rhetoric, and you're not going to burst into flames of liberalism by reading a book like this. Like, you know, like it's that idea is, man, if you give an inch to these thoughts, then you're just going to be a liberal, a socialist. You're going to be, you know, you're, with CRT. This is all about CRT, and you're going to completely rewrite American history. And like we're saying in the book, guys, let us show you where American history was already rewritten. Yeah. Through the lost cause narrative and other things. Like, it's okay to listen and to learn. And we're two believers who are walking that path. So we're not trying to push a far left agenda or something. Like, we're trying to push the agenda of seeing God, invited into an intervention of a major problem in our country today that we believe he cares about, and that he's given us through his gospel the means to address it in a way that honors him and honors his ways.
So good. So good, you guys. Thank you so much. This is the book, Not So Black and White, also titled My One Black Friend. But try to find it on Amazon at Not So Black and White. And you guys, I'm so grateful for your time and for this writing, for the sacrifice, the vulnerability, the care that you guys put into this content. And I know that it's already changing minds and it's already changing lives. And I hope that this conversation helps us make one more step towards really a better future for our children, our grandchildren, and this nation. So thank you guys for your time. So grateful.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the Let's Be Real podcast. If you have a question for the show, you can send it to me at Nicole@NicoleEunice.com. And hey, if you're enjoying this, we'd love for you to like, subscribe, share it with your friends, pass it on, shout it from the rooftops, whatever you feel like doing, because the reality is, let's get as many people getting real as possible. Talk to you soon.